The views and opinions expressed by individuals on the following program do not necessarily reflect those of the network, Guys Guy Radio, and its platforms. It's Guys Guy Radio. Here's your host, Robert Manny.
Welcome to Guys Guy Radio. This is your host, Robert Manny, welcoming you to the show where men and women can be at their best and everyone wins, Guys Guys Radio. We're here to inform you, inspire you, empower you, and get you to think, feel, and who knows, maybe even act by virtue of the journeys, stories, experiences, and insights of the guests I bring you each and every week to the show. Once again, this week is no exception. Today we're going to talk about what's going on up in LA right now, post fires, and we're also going to talk about how and if you can make a living as a freelance writer. Our return guest is Larry Grobel, who I consider, and many others consider, the world's greatest interviewer. He's done it all. He's made a career as a freelance writer and has covered the waterfront, if you will, in terms of every type of experience you could have. And he's written about everything in every form. And he's most well known for his amazing feature interviews with Playboy magazine. So I'm delighted that Larry's come back to the show. And I think it's a really important show because, number one, he's going to give us an update. He's an Angeleno who's a New Yorker but lives in LA. He's going to tell us what's been going on from the time of the fires to now. And also we're going to get into his path, his journey in terms of becoming a successful freelance reporter and the traits and things you need to do to be able to succeed nowadays as a freelance reporter. And he's written a book about it called Hustle, The Making of a Freelance Writer. The man we need to listen to about this has done it all is Larry Grobel. And I'm delighted he's coming back to Guys Guys Radio to share with us all of his insights from his storied career as what I consider the world's greatest interviewer.
Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, Guys Guys Radio. It is the interview portion of our show, and I'm delighted to welcome back one of our favorite guests here on Guys Guys Radio, an inspiration to me, somebody I consider to be the world's greatest interviewer. He's done it all. His name is Larry Grobel, author of over 30 books. Amongst his honors are the National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship for his fiction, Special Achievement Awards from PEN for his conversations with Capote, and Playboy for his interviews with none other than Barbara Streisand, Dolly Parton, Marlon Brando, Al Pacino, and many, many more. I can go on and on, but Larry has written over 30 books. He's been on the show a few times talking about the art of the interview. We're going to talk about one of his books today. It's called Hustle, The Making of the Freelance Writer. And it's really tough to be a freelance writer these days because, you know, people don't read as much. So 60 years profiling rascals, rednecks, artists, cowboys, composers, hustlers, comics, refugees, stuntmen, prodigies, singers, icons, and legends. Welcome back to Guys Guys Radio, Larry Grobel.
Thank you so much, Robert. And congratulations on your success with this show, because I remember when you first started. And so you keep doing it. You keep talking.
Thank you. Yeah, we've gotten over, we've interviewed close to 800 thought leaders like yourself, and we've done 650 plus shows now. So it just keeps rolling. And now our platforms are expanding also. And we're also on UK Health Radio now, which is the world's largest talk health station. So I write a column for them called Aging is a Choice. I've done 25 columns so far in the series, and the brand keeps expanding in a nice way. We're here to help people, and you're an inspiration to me, Larry, and I learned a lot from you reading your books, talking to you, interviewing you, and I can't wait to do it again today. So welcome back to the show, and let's get started. So the one thing I wanted to start with, you're, like myself, you're an East Coast guy, New Yorker, out in L.A., I'm here in down in Carlsbad, but I'm an East Coast guy also, and a New Yorker, and life's a little bit different out here. I'm learning each year I'm out here. I learn a little bit more about some of the subtle differences and some of the big differences. But the big news has been you're in LA, and you had the fires, and then after the fires recently, you had a lot of rain, you had mudslides. And I think for our audience, I think they would like to know from somebody who's a very honest, authentic person, what was your take on it? What's going on now? And what are the perspectives for the future? What's your take, Larry?
Well, first of all, it was truly a devastating, never before seen kind of experience here. I mean, to lose the Pacific Palisades the way we did, and Altadena, two major areas that are beloved by the people who live there. I mean, the Altadena people are none. Right now there are developers who are offering big money to take over the land. They're fighting against it. They say we want to rebuild, and it's really heroic. The Palisades, I have a friend in both places, in Altadena and in the Palisades. They lost their homes completely. One is Paul McCarthy, who's an artist who is, I've written about it. As a matter of fact, he's in Hustle. I wrote he's one of the three artists, and he lost his home. And Paul's art, he was teaching at UCLA. When I knew him, I was able to buy some of his work for $50 to help him out. And now his art goes for $5 million. I mean, it's quite something to have
I hope you've
seen.
held on to
I do. I have it.
it.
And I had lunch with him a few years ago, and I said, "Paul, that thing I got from you?" And he says, "You still have that?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Did I sign it?" I said, "Yeah, you did." He says, "Well, it's worth 150." And I said, "Gee, that's not that much from the $50 I gave you." I could have said 150. He was talking thousands, but I don't know if that's true. But still, it's quite something, and it's just so incredibly sad. And then my other friend, who is an actor who acted with Pacino in, which was the children's type movie. Anyway, the one that he has kid there's kids in it. But anyway, he is married to Bing Crosby's granddaughter, and they lost, and she's in Star Trek and all. And they lost their home in the Palisades. They were in New York. They came back on a Monday and got evacuated that next day, and never even took their extra shoes with them. They just got in the car and they had to leave. It was that kind of an experience. It was, and then I talked to him a few days later, and he said, "It's all gone. Everything is gone." Well, and now they're stuck with trying to find a place to live. And then, do you live for a short period of time? Can you rent a place? And everybody's gouging with the rents and all that stuff. I have people calling me saying, "Sell your house now. Sell your house now. You'll get $1 million more." And it's just so greedy. It's just the wrong feeling about that kind of stuff. But I mean, I visited Mike Medavoy. He lived in Mandeville Canyon, and they were on evacuation notice for, the whole time the fires were going on. He had a house that I'd never seen. I mean, the backyard was like a giant, nice swimming pool and a tennis court and a view of the ocean. And you could see down all the way down Malibu, that area. And you could go all the way down to the, towards the San Diego area. I mean, it was just like, I've never seen such an expansive view. And he didn't lose his house, as far as I know. But they had fire trucks all up and down Mandeville Canyon, just waiting for the fires to hit. You know what I mean? I started thinking, well, if you're really rich, you're probably paying for these fire trucks to stay there, to stay put. Maybe they're private, whatever. So, you sort of see the difference. I mean, it was a very expensive area. The Palisades is one of the most expensive areas in LA. And to see the kind of total destruction, there's one house that lasted. There's some guy built a small two-bedroom, three-bedroom house that was fireproof. I mean, and it was, no one knew if it was really going to be that way. It held up. That house The only house around there, you see all of everything is devastated. This house held up, which is probably the answer to what's going to have to happen. You're going to have to build that way. You're going to have to build in concrete. You're going to have to build with gravel. You know, I mean, it's just like you can't plant the kind of plants that you'd like to have. It's a real change, you know, in how people are going to perceive LA and these areas. I was evacuated. I live in the Hollywood Hills. And I get a call from Larry Schiller. Now, Larry Schiller is one of the great iconic figures in this city. You know, he made a did a lot of books with Norman Mailer. He, you know, the Executioner song, and he did all the interviews for it. And he did they made a movie out of it. And he, you know, he was an he's an entrepreneur and he's a photographer. He did Marilyn. I wrote two books for him, Larry Schiller. One on Marilyn Monroe, Marilyn and Me, it's called. And the other on Barbra Streisand, both of them with Taschen books, sold for $1,000, $2,000, and then it came out in smaller editions. And he calls me up and he says, "Don't you live in Nichols Canyon?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Get the hell out of there." He says, "Get the hell out of here. You're on fire." Like that. I mean, I wasn't watching TV. I was working at my computer. I didn't see anything. I quickly turn on the television and there it is. Runyon Canyon is on fire, which is 5 minutes from my house, and we walk there regularly. And you know, all of a sudden it's like we had to get out. And I said to my wife, you know,
Where'd you go?
heck, we went to Roy Firestone's house. Roy is an old friend of mine. He lived
Sure.
next door, but he lives in the valley in Encino. And I called him up and I said, "How you doing?" He says, "Oh, we're fine here." I said, "I'm coming for a I'm coming to stay with you," because he has an extra bedroom. I've stayed there before and I've had to. So we went there and we only had to stay one night, and then they let us back in. So we got lucky because the fire. They put that fire out in Runyon Canyon very quickly. It's one of the only success stories of the fires that happened, and it's because it was heading all the way down to Hollywood Boulevard, and it was going to, you know, that they were worried that Hollywood itself was going to, you know, the area down there was going to catch on fire. So they managed to get that out, luckily for us. But boy, I
Did
every friend, go
did
ahead.
you, Larry? Is it where you are? Can you still smell the fires? What's it like
No, not
driving
now.
around? Have you seen any of the damage? Have you gone out and take a look for yourself, or what?
I've seen some, but you know, when we go down to the gym, I've seen ha so certain houses. I've seen, you know, that have gone, but they don't let you into those areas. Even my friends who's lost their homes weren't allowed in the area. They didn't see their house until I think a week ago. You know, I mean, because first of all, you know, a lot of these fires, there's like embers that are underground that it still burns. You know, I mean, it's interesting. So when the wind blows and some of that dirt blows up. The embers come up again. Who knew about that? You know, an underground fire that's still molting and waiting to burn. I've seen what's on television. I've seen the photographs. I've seen, you know, what's overhead when they do the, you know, the helicopter things. Like, so what if you've seen it on TV? But this place is never going to be the same. I mean, it to rebuild what they have to do, it's going to take years. It's just. You know, there was a woman who you know went back to her house, and she going through the rubble, she found her wedding ring. You know that, imagine that. Just inside that, there was her wedding ring. One moment of gratitude and happiness in a, and you know you don't realize. I mean, when we were evacuated, we grabbed what I could. I threw things I didn't take any of my books, the books I've written. I didn't take any of my first edition books. Some of them are worth thousands of dollars. I didn't take any of my archive. You know, that's what I'm trying to sell right now to institutions. Didn't take that. Didn't take all the things signed by everybody that I have. I didn't take any of that stuff. I didn't even take a picture of my mother and father. My wife took a picture of her mother and father. You know, we just went whatever we could grab. You know, so you know, we took certain things, and you know, I take a few jackets for different times. I just thought we were going to lose the house. You know, that was my opinion. I said, if this canyon goes up, no, nothing's going to survive. But you
Wow.
know, once we didn't, I still have everything packed downstairs, ready to go. You know, I grabbed what was important as the documents. You know, I got the
Right.
passport, the things like that, the checkbook. I didn't even take mine. My wife managed to take hers. But you realize. You better really think fast about this stuff. You better be prepared the next time. So, I think I won't unpack. I'm still, I'm the underwear I took away. I'm not putting it out anymore. I'm leaving it in my luggages and stuff. I'm just, it's just such a bizarre kind of have way to live.
We were just talking about what's going on with the fire there and where you live, and then being prepared for the next time. So, what are your neighbors and people who live in the area? What do they feel like emotionally? Are they pointing fingers? Are they trying to help each other? And are they ready for the next time? Because obviously, this could happen again.
Yeah, no, I don't know anybody who's really ever gets ready for anything. They tell you, got to get ready for the earthquake, got to get ready,
Right.
food. Nobody really gets ready for things. It just happens, and then the next one happens, and it's because it, this was this one still hasn't been digested. I mean, it's and then you have the president blaming the that there wasn't enough forest cleaning and this and that. I hate the idea of blame. Right now it's such a disaster. All people should come together, and they have come together in a lot of areas. There's been a lot of help. You have a lot of millions of dollars have been raised. And people have
Right.
done things for it. So, but in a certain way, like my sister kept saying, come to out New York, you got to get out of there. The air is not breathable. But we're up in this canyon, we're sitting outside, and we feel you can't tell. So, do we wear masks? We haven't. We've sort of gotten back to what we hope normal. Start going back to the gym. I mean, Universal Studios, Universal City, where with the walk and all, that was closed down for and that's never been closed like that. I mean, it's just it's hard to believe that it's going to happen again, but you never know. I was robbed. I went to Europe for I went to the Camera Image Film Festival. I'm a judge there on a yearly basis, whenever I can get there in November. And I then went to Madrid to see my daughter, and I came back home, and my whole house was a wreck. I thought we had an earthquake. Someone broke in. Someone got in through a window and stole all the my wife's jewelry, stole the girl a lot of stuff
Sure.
that was, and that feeling of being invaded.
Violated, yeah, violated,
All
right?
the police, they come, they check you out. You make a list of everything. You're never going to see it again. You call your insurance company, they tell you, oh, you have a $25,000 deductible. It's like,
Thanks.
it's stuff, right? Yeah, I'm
So
sure.
let me last ask you this, Larry. Just you mentioned Trump, so let's put him aside. Is there any feeling, though, of folks who live there, and obviously LA and California is mostly liberal? Is there any feeling that maybe we could have been prepared a little bit better for this?
Of course. There was a budget cut of $17 million or something for the fire department, and so now the fire chief came out and said, "Listen, we could have used that money. We could, of course." I don't think it would have made much of a difference in this fire. This fire, you had winds that blew up to 90 miles an hour. I mean, it was like almost hurricane type wind. So the fire was being spread from ember to ember, and that you hit another tree, boom, that would go up. So I'm not sure how much anything could have been done. You couldn't fly the planes with the overhead for a long time until the wind died down a bit. You can't aim water down straight, and then it has goes all the way to the left or right. So it's like it this was just a real freak of nature in a way. How much of it has to do with climate change? I suspect a lot. I suspect we're going to be having more of these things. I suspect we're going to have to be more and more prepared. But the preparation is going to be in, fire roof control. You're going to have fireproof roofing. You're going to have to separate. I mean, my insurance company already sent somebody here. I had to pay him $95 to come take pictures of my house. And then they told me I failed. Where did I fail? Way in the back of my house. A couple of plants are not separated enough. I mean, this has been here. I've been here for 30, 45 years. Now I'm out there cleaning and cleaning. I was cutting. But I know that nobody wants to insure you anymore. That's another big problem that's going to happen here. What happens when all these insurance companies won't insure? How do you even sell your house one day when if you can't find insurance and you're always stuck on the California FAIR plan? And I had that once before. It's not a great plan, but and it's going to cost a lot of money. But This is the way it is. This is living in California, living in paradise, so to speak. It can turn into hell, and we see that the mudslides that happened, weren't terrible. Those rains didn't hit as bad as we thought it could, but who knows what's next? And when is that earthquake coming? I mean,
Right,
when is that going to
exactly.
happen? So it's like, we can survive the 6 and 7 point earthquake, but what are going to happen when it's an eight,
Right.
one in
Well,
nine?
at least the Dodgers have signed all the free agents if possible, so
They got
they're going to
Otani.
win the
They
World Series for the next
got
5 years.
Yeah, really. Yeah,
So
and I'm a Yankee fan. What can you tell you?
me too. It's like, and a Padres fan. So like, oh my God, it's like double death there. So let's get into the work. So thank you for sharing what's going on there, and it's such a tragedy. And hang in there. And it sounds like you're staying. So you're a real Angeleno now, and you're
Yeah.
not going anywhere. So good for you. You've made a living as a freelance writer, and you've written fiction, nonfiction, poetry, screenplays, interview books, and you're a legend. And you put this book together called Hustle, The Making of a Freelance Writer. And it comes at a time where it's tougher than ever to make a living as a freelance writer. So let's just start. There's the cover of the book Larry's holding up for those who are viewing. And
Back. I was on the
see the
cover of
back.
Writer's Digest at
I
one
know that's a very nice photo. So
point.
let's start with why did you decide to come out with this book in like about a year or so ago? What was your
I
impetus
was,
for doing this one?
well, I've written hundreds and hundreds of articles. And what I was thinking one day, there's a lot of circumstances that allow you to live the way you live. When I was in Africa, I was teaching at the Ghana Institute of Journalism. Some guy just wrote me. Now, I was there in 68 to 71. And I remember being asked to teach at this institution, and whatever. And it was an important time in my life, and I did it. And I think it's one of the major moments in my life. He was reading my book, Turquoise. So he's 80 years old now. He was also in West Africa, and he was from Canada. And he said, "I'm reading your book, and you talk about a teacher who had taught at the Institute of Journalism before you, and had left to go to Nigeria, and then went back to Canada, and he died in an apartment fire. And you said his name was whatever, Bob Jones." He says, "Well, I know who that was, but his name wasn't Bob Jones. It was Robert Smith." And so I had the name wrong, but that's what I was told. I was only told about this guy. And he says, and I was asked, this guy's writing me, he says, I was asked to go to replace him, and I couldn't do it. And it ended up you were replacing it. You got to replace it. So I thought, what are those circumstances that happen all lives if I didn't wouldn't have taught there, I would have been in some village somewhere. I would have taught had a totally different experience. So I was thinking about what are the moments in my career that pushed my career forward or taught me a lesson that allowed me to make decisions about continuing as a freelance writer, because there were so many times you could get discouraged. And some of the things that I put in the book are things that were rejected, things that never got published, but that I worked my ass off on, for months and months, and flew to California and came back. But they were important to me, because those are the ones where I went up to an attic and cried, "I'm never going to make it in this business. I'm never going to be a freelance writer." And then I said, "I'm going to do it. I'm going to, show these people." And I've had that kind of feeling about myself, I guess, since I was 12, 13 years old, and I used to send poetry to the Atlantic, Esquire, all the major publications. Some of them didn't even use poetry, but some of them once in a while did. The New Yorker, I would send my poetry, and they would get rejected over and over and over again. And I'd get rejection notices, but they never were signed. They were always just, automatic rejection. So I said, "No one's reading it. They're just rejecting it." One day I get one from Esquire, and it says, "Sorry, no," underlined, and it had his name, Don. And I said, and because what I had done is I made a cork board and I
You got
put
a
up,
name.
All my rejections on the corkboard when I was growing up, and that name went right in the middle. I said, "Someone read it, I'm getting there." But I was determined. I was actually de very determined to get my stuff out there because I believed in myself. Well, so I thought it would be interesting to have a book for my grandchildren, of the articles or the interviews or whatever, the essays that I wrote that moved the career along some way that allowed me to make this life to now. And that's it. I did it. I mean, somehow I was able to freelance my way through life. So that's what the making of a freelance writer is. It's so I started looking at all the articles I've written, and I started going through them from the very beginning. And I said, oh, well, I got to include the one where I won the Newsday American History Contest. I was 15 years old. It got published. I got a watch. I got to meet the well, I was supposed to meet President Kennedy, but he was gone to Berlin. So I met Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, not the guy who's in charge now. So these were important moments. What that showed me was writing paid. Writing made me known. My school, they announced that over the PA, Larry Gravel just won this thing. Congratulate him or something. My picture got in the newspaper with this girl who also won, and then. So, it was those kinds of things that I said, well, okay, that should go in. When I went to UCLA, I joined this humor magazine, and they let me write. They did a parody of The New Yorker, so I did a story there. It's not a very good piece I wrote. I'm not. It's not. These are not the world's best pieces, but these are the pieces that move the needle, and that's why I put them in. And then there's like
Okay.
something like Tony Bennett. I interviewed Tony Bennett because he asked me to write his book. I spent so much time with Tony Bennett. He came to my house. We had dinner. I went up to San Francisco, all this crazy stuff with him. And then he decided he didn't want to do the book and he didn't want to pay me a dime. She was very cheap. And then so I talked to his lawyer. I said, listen, I did all this work, He says, well, sorry, So I said, well, one day I'll put it out there. I never did put it out there. I put it in the book, though. It's a 12,000-word
Amazing.
interview
I
with
read it.
Tony
It was
Bennett.
good. Well, it's a fast, it's a fast hustle. It's a fascinating book because you cover everything from artists, a couple, three artists, I think, are in a book, composers, cowboys, Colombian cowboys, refugees, people in Africa and Ghana, and also Mae West. So what I wanted to ask you, Larry, is you're best known. Obviously, you're a Renaissance man when it comes to writing. You can write anything. Screenplays, poems, fiction, nonfiction, but you're most well known for your interviews, and you're considered the world's greatest interviewer. And you've interviewed some of the toughest interviews out there, some really high, talented, famous, big ego celebrities who are tough to get to. What was the linchpin that convinced you that you could, make a living interviewing people? I know you got into Playboy and you got to Hefner, and he's in the book also. But what was it when the light bulb went off for you, Larry, to said, I am really good at this, and this can separate me from everybody else in that very highly competitive field of writing?
Well, when I started doing the interviews, it was Newsday. They wanted me to start interviewing people called household names. So I said, okay, who do you want? And they said, okay, Mae West. I said, you mean I can do any household name? He says, well, who do you want to do? So I started saying, I want to do Linus Pauling. They said, okay, I want to do Henry Moore. I want to do a great artist. They said, okay. What other artist could I have done? No other artist except Andy Warhol, they have said, and Warhol didn't want to do it. So then I got to what writers could I do? Well, I would throw out all my writers. No. Ray Bradbury. Okay, do Ray Bradbury. So I did Ray Bradbury. Sorry about this. And then I did Lucille Ball. And I did Carol Burnett. And I, you know, and Warren Beatty, who never talked to anybody, because people respected Newsday. So the thing was, I got interested in the idea of, gee, what would I, I felt I only had the right to talk to them for a couple of hours, 3 hours at the most, because, it's a I needed a 3,000-word interview, and I knew I could do it in that period of time. But I thought, what would it be like to really do an interview, to really go into someone's life, to spend a week, a month, who knows, And I said the only place to do that was Playboy. So when I went at, when I went to do it for Playboy. And they said, who are you working on? And finally got to, I said, I'm what Streisand was one of the ones I was working on. Okay, if you can get the Streisand, we'll be interested. That was the impetus. Now that was the challenge. I mean, it took me a long time to get to her, and then it took me almost 9 months to do the interview because, and I wasn't getting paid. But that was the moment I when I w because Playboy realized it as well. Playboy saw that I was not going to ever give up, and that when I turned it in, they really liked it, and I got her to do the cover of be on the cover as well, which even Hefner didn't want to put her on the cover, but they it went on the cover. So that, and that's when I realized, well, I didn't quite realize it then. I mean, I knew that, that I got on the cover of Writer's Digest because of that, so I sort of saw, oh, this is something. But then Playboy came along and asked me, are you sitting down? We got Marlon Brando to agree to do an interview. We'd like you to do it. Now, I had only done Barbara, Dolly Parton, and Henry Winkler. So I've only did three Playboy interviews, and now they're asking me to do what I thought was the greatest actor. I think he still is the greatest actor I've ever produced. He's a recluse. He lives on an island in Tahiti, and they're giving me the assignment, and I kept thinking, why are they giving this to me instead of all of their regulars? And I think one of the reasons was they knew it was going to take a long time, and they knew that they saw that with the other with their more professional interviewers, no one's going to spend that much time without getting paid. I was still at that novice stage where I was willing to work, get research, get it ready, and if it happens, great. And then, and that was the challenge. Could I do a good interview with a guy who said he'll only talk about the American Indians? That was it. And I said, that's not an interview. And so I did what I could. I got the interview done as best I could. And when I got home, my editor says to me, how did it go? I said, well, I said it was fascinating to be there, I mean, but he says, I only have one thing to tell you. He says, what? He says, 10%. I said, 10%? What's that? That's all I want about the Indians. I said, 90% about the Indians. He goes, that's all I want is 10%. So I said, okay. So I really had to work to make that interview work. I mean, I
Okay.
really had
So when you went to when you went over there, Larry, first time, what was it like meeting Brando? What was the first thing he said to you? And how did you meet him?
Well, I flew over there. I got there in the middle of the night into Tahiti, and then I had to go to a hotel in that night. And then the next day, I was going to fly out. I flew over to his tapir
Playboy
row.
pay for the flight?
Playboy pays for everything. Yeah,
Okay.
I mean, I mean, Playboy throughout my career with Playboy,
Okay.
that was a given. Otherwise, you can't afford to do that stuff.
Got it.
So I flew over there, and I get off the and Tarita, his wife, was there, and so was Cheyenne, who was 8 years old, the girl who later on committed suicide, all that problem. So I get off. I had sandals on, and he meets me. He meets them, gives her a kiss, takes the kid, and then he comes over to me, and I said, "Hi, I'm Larry." He goes, "I know who you are." He goes, "Yeah." I mean, it was all these shenanigans getting to him, I said, okay, so, and then he took my bag, my duffel bag, whatever I had, and he carries it, and he's taking me to my little hut where I'm going to stay. And as we walk, he looks down at my feet and he says something about my sandals. He says, those sandals aren't going to work here. It's going to, the sand will get between your toes, this, that. And we just started talking, and I'm going, it's Marlon Brando. Marlon Brando is carrying my bag and leading me to where I'm going to be staying. And then he sat down, and we sat down together in the room that I was going to be in. I gave him a present. I gave him a William Colby, Colby's CIA book, and I gave him a tin of Famous Amos cookies. And I said, here, this is for you. He says, oh, I can't eat these. I'm going to diet. I said, okay, no problem. And of course, as we talked, he opened it and he ate every cookie. He didn't do anything. I mean, he just kept
Awesome.
eating cookies. And then I had a telescope, a small one, that I had brought. I didn't know what I was going to be looking at, but I was in the sea or whatever. And he picks it up and he looked at the telescope, and then he starts doing this. And he says, you know how far that thing is? And he starts saying, and he's telling me it's about 10 times away from where we are. It's about, and he's giving me like he knows all this stuff. And I thought, okay, that's pretty interesting. And then when he left, I looked at the thing that, and I looked at the telescope, and it said a 10 times, the strength. So that. So I saw that he fooled around a bit.
What was the biggest surprise? Like the thing where you had this idea of okay, Marlon Brando, he's going to be quirky, he's going to be eccentric, and then you spend a week or so with him, What was your change of heart in any way when you met him?
It was that he had a great sense of humor. He had a lot of knowledge. He knew about a lot of things, and quirky things too. I mean, he could talk about the saliva of a camel. He could talk about and as we would walk and talk, I would say, "Marlon, Marlon, let's save this for." He goes, for 3 days, he wouldn't let me turn the tape recorder on. So for 3 days, we're walking and talking. And I'm telling him all about my life, and he was interested. But I, a lot of people aren't interested in you; they're only interested in
Right,
themselves.
of course.
He was interested. He was a great actor. Why was he a great actor? Because he was a great observer. Also, he was studying me, and I didn't know this till later because he had agreed to play George Lincoln Rockwell on Roots. When the Roots was coming out, and Roots, his character George gets interviewed by Alex Haley for Playboy. And so he's, in a sense, preparing
Right.
for his role by being interviewed by me. And I didn't know that until later on, and I saw, oh, that's what was going on there. But we played chess together. We went out on boat, the boat, the catamaran or whatever, for an evening excursion, just the two of us. We did, I played chess, and he would put the He saw I wasn't a great chess player, so he put a cardboard between the play pieces when we set it up. Then he says, "Set up the pieces any way you want, and then we'll just take it out. And we'll play from there." And I thought I'd be cool.
That's hilarious.
I put my queen up front, and I'd
Yeah.
show him. And he took my queen, and I said, "Boy, am I stupid?" But
So after it was a couple of questions, Larry, was and everybody, I just want to take a quick break and mention that Larry Grobel, the world's greatest interviewer, is my special guest, return guest on Guys Guys Radio. So thank you for being here. We're talking about brand, though. There's so much more in this book, Hustle, about Larry's kind of breakthrough as a making a living as a freelance writer. But just to put a button on Brando, was he pleased with the work you did with him, number one, and did you stay in touch with him afterwards?
Yes and no for both. He wrote me a letter, and he wrote me a letter, and the first line was, "Disappointment is simmering and something, whatever." He was disappointed in the first line of the thing, and then he started getting phone calls from people who had read the
I
interview.
loved it,
They loved it, and he says, "Upon further request, I'm hearing from people
right?
that and then he says, "Thank you for making me more articulate than I remember being." And then and he was very friendly towards the last ad. Our experience was a good one. And then P.S. fuck the press. It was a great letter, 3-page letter. So and then I was going. He wanted me to work on the sterilization of the American Indian women, and so I got Playboy to agree to finance that to allow me to do the research. And Marlon set me up with people, and I was interviewed. And it was an interesting story that couldn't get written because the women who were sterilized over the years would not talk about it. They just,
Sure.
and so that's their culture, and they that were ashamed from it. So rather than exploit it or even this, bring it out. So I never did write the article, but I did keep in touch with Marlon. He came to my house once, during that time that before the interview had come out. But we kept in touch over the phone and everything. And then after what happened with Christian, and after, I lost touch. I mean, everybody did. He,
Right.
but I kept in touch with his secretary.
Okay. How would you relate? Okay, you've all of these different celebrities and artists that you've interviewed. Thinking back now, who's the first person you think of, even when I just threw that at you?
Well, it's always usually the people that I ended up doing books about, the ones I got involved with the longest, Truman Capote, John Huston, Marlon, Pacino, Barbra Streisand, Dolly Parton. These
How do you compare Pacino to Brando in terms of artists and their approach?
Well, they're both really good artists. I would say Brando was a great artist, a great actor. I think both of them had movies that you'd be embarrassed by, that weren't as great as they could be, and they did it for the money, I mean, playing Superman's father, Jor-El, what's he doing with that one? Well, he's making $4 million for the part and $17 million or something for the little figure that they made,
Right.
the toy. When Al Pacino did that Adam Sandler movie, I was really embarrassed for him. I said, "Why would you do that?" Oh, well, but I know that Al got offered sometimes $9 million. Sometimes he once had a script, $17 million they offered him to do a movie. And he said he wasn't sure. He gave me the script to read. I said, "I don't know how to read it. Just do it." I said, "For $17 million, do the damn thing. It'll disappear." He says, "Read it first." I read it. It was a terrible script, and it was a misogynist script, and it was really negative about women. I said, "You can't do this," and he didn't. But then he still has done Merchant of Venice. He's done some good movies, says, but not he's done hasn't done
You
any
stay in
really
touch with
great.
him? He did Dunkachino too, right?
Excuse me?
He did Dunkachino too, the Dunkin' Donuts
Dunkachino.
ads.
Yeah, that was Alan's that Sandler one. But I stay in touch with him, but we had a falling out, and it happened when he asked me to be in his movie Salome, it's Wild Salome, and I was in the movie, but I said, "What am I doing in this movie?" He says, "Well, you'll be my biographer. We'll say you're my biographer." I said, "Well, if I'm going to be your biographer, why don't I write a book about it?" And he said, "Fine, that's good." So I did. I wrote a book. It's called I Want You in My Movie. But what happened was, I brought it to him. I had a publisher, and I brought the book to. I said, "Al, I got a publisher." And he got nervous. He says, No, you can't have it. You can't publish a book until the movie's out." I said, "They're not going to publish it until the movie's out, but it takes a year sometimes for a book publisher to put it out. So don't worry about it." And I said, "And besides, this is a project we did together. I'm not trying." He kept saying, "You're going to do a job on me. You're going to do a job on me." I said, "Why would I do a job on you? I've known you for 35 years. We've been close friends. And you can go over the entire manuscript. That you'll make it better. That's great." Well, what happened was, I gave him the manuscript. We went over it. I thought this was going great. The first page or two, he said, "No, this didn't work out this way. It went this way." I said, "Great." So I'm making all these notes. And then the next thing I know, his lawyer calls and says, "I want you to sign one of those non-disclosure
NDA, yeah.
can't write about anything about him without his permission." I said, "No, that's something you give to people who work for you, your driver, your maid. You don't do that with friends." I said, that there's a matter of trust when you're a friend." And he said, "That's what he wants." I said, well, I'm not doing it. And so then I met with him. I said, "What's going on with you?" And he went crazy. He turned into Michael Corleone, and I became Fredo, And I realized he had read something. Al doesn't read his reviews. I respect him for that, and I know it's true that he doesn't. So, but when he did the Salome thing, I brought Joyce Carol Oates to one night to see it. I brought A. Talese one night, and I brought Anthony Hopkins one night. I had Al's seats, so I could bring anybody I want. And so I was bring and I purposely was doing that so for my book I could write about these major people and what they thought about it. But what happened is, the LA Times and the Village something here in LA, they hated it. They really did. They said he's like Jerry Lewis. He's acting like a the Herod, King Herod. But Joyce Carol Oates said, "Did you see that thing in the Times?" She said to me, "That's how could they say that? He did that." So I needed her comments. But you gotta put what the review was to get the comments in there. I think what happened, because I don't know this for sure, but I think what happened is, he opened to the page where the review, where I quote some of the review, got totally upset and said, "That's it. That's it. This can't happen." Whatever. So I canceled the book contract, but I put it out by myself, and we had a falling out. Now we are talking now, but I didn't write his book, the one that just came out. I didn't have anything to do with it. And it's just a shame. We had a really close friendship.
All right. Larry Grobelt, my very special guest on Guys, Guys Radio. Unfortunately, we're out of time. It went so quickly. The name of the book that we're talking about today is Hustle, The Making of a Freelance Writer. He's holding it up again. I love it.
I
And
have to hold it up. You don't
so,
have
real
it.
quick, and can you do this in like 30 seconds? Should people become freelance writers or not? Do you recommend that as a path if you're really passionate about it?
I think freelancing is a great way to go, because you don't get stuck the way the people look at what's happening now with all the people being fired who work for the government. You just never know. My father worked his whole life. He was given a job. He was vice president of a company. They told him he was going to be the president. He's going to take over. But what happened when the guy died? His sons got it.
Of
My father
course.
got it. It happens to everybody. Yes, if you can freelance, if you can find something you're good at, try it. Go for it. If you can make a
Got it.
living from it, great.
Thank you so much for being on the show again. Thank you for everything you've done, everything you're doing, and everything you're going to do. So hang in there, Larry. Keep doing great work, and we'll have you back again soon. All right?
Yeah, then we'll talk about the Cowboys.
Okay.
And the Black Eagle. The Black Eagle. That's another
There's
one.
So many great stories in the book. It's called Hustle, The Making of a Freelance Writer. Check it out, folks. Larry Grobel.
Thank you.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, what a terrific conversation. Always interesting, Larry Grobel, and he has so much insights, and he's had such an amazing life up to now, and much more to come. The book, once again, is called Hustle, The Making of a Freelance Writer. We talked about that, and we talked about what's going on in LA post-fires. And Larry's up there. So Larry, like many other Angelenos that I know, they are not taking the government up there to task as much as I expected they would. And they are making sure they do what they can to protect themselves going forward. And I think that's obviously a good idea. And wow, what a tragedy up there. Secondly, we talked about Larry's book, Hustle, and how to make it as a freelance writer. And I think one of the things we learned in terms of a couple of tips in terms of how to make it, you got to believe in yourself. You got to be lucky, as Larry mentioned, some of the, you know, those key points where he got his first interview for Playboy. He's got introduced to somebody at the magazine and got the opportunity to really make things happen there. And you also have to be persistent and diligent. Larry, like all writers, had gotten a lot of rejections, but you got to hang in there and believe that you have something to say and really put your work out there with passion and belief and curiosity and openness. He's really open-minded about people and really reports from the heart. And I think he does an amazing job, and he's an inspiration for anybody who wants to be a writer. And he's been a true inspiration for me as doing what I do. And I've learned so much about the art of interviewing from the one and only Larry Grobel. So I'm delighted that he came back to the show this week, and he'll be back again. We've got plenty more because Larry has so much content to cover that we'll do another amazing show in the near future. Larry Grobel, my special guest on Guys Guys Radio. Okay, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Guys Guys Radio on UK Health Radio. We're back next week with another great show. And until then, like I always say, guys, finish first.